Praise be Jesus Christ, and welcome to another episode of Carmelcast. Carmelcast is a production of the Institute of Carmelite Studies Publications. For more information, you can visit our website at www.icspublications.org. We're continuing our season on prayer because Pope Francis has named this year, 2024, a year of prayer. And so it's really a time for us to learn from the wisdom of the Carmelite saints. For those of us who are just beginning to pray and for those of us who are well on our way. My name is Brother John Mary of Jesus Crucified, and I'm very happy to be joined by Father Stephen Payne with us today. Welcome, Father Stephen.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes. Father Stephen is the chair of the Center of Carmelite Studies at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. He's also done, you know, a great number of things for our province of Discalced Carmelites, some of which related to our publications as well. And so he's very knowledgeable on our Carmelite saints and prayer. So we're very, very happy to have him with us today. I'm going to start, Father Stephen, by asking you a question that I didn't warn you about ahead of time, so put you on the spot a little bit. Since we're focusing on prayer this season, particularly, I think, in a practical way, if you had to give people just some practical advice about prayer, one kind of piece of information, what would you say?
I just say pray as you can. I think that's always Teresa's advice, basically, is wherever we are, whatever point we've reached, just pray the way that works for us, you know, and don't try to force our prayer into a type of prayer that doesn't work for us, and keep it simple, and so on. And I just think persistence is the most important thing. Teresa says determined determination.
That's great. And it's something that's come up a lot in our episodes is the idea that Carmelite prayer, the Carmelite method of, or if you want to even use method, the Carmelite approach to prayer is something that's very free. It's not kind of constrained to one particular way of approaching prayer, but there's a sort of freedom to allow God to work within us during that time of prayer. Well, that's great, and it dovetails really with what we want to talk about today, which is the practice of the presence of God. The practice of the presence of God. So I'll just start by saying, like, well, what is the practice of the presence of God?
Yeah. Well, thanks. I think that we Carmelites, we associate that phrase with Brother Lawrence of the Resurrection and the book called The Practice of the Presence of God, which is a collection of his letters and his conversations and so on. He defines it this way, if I can give a quote from him, if this would be helpful.
Yeah, definitely.
The holiest, most ordinary, and most necessary practice of the spiritual life is that of the presence of God. It is to take delight in and to become accustomed to his divine company, speaking humbly and conversing lovingly with him at all times, at every moment, without rule or measure, as we were saying, especially in times of temptation, suffering, aridity, weariness, and even infidelity and sin. We must continually apply ourselves so that all our actions, without exception, become a kind of brief conversation with God. Mm-hmm. And that was his approach, it's sometimes called a methodless method, because you're just trying to be mindful of the fact all the time that you're in the presence of God. And that's not a intimidating presence. You know, we're not paranoid that God is always watching us, but it's a loving attention that we know that we're always there in the presence of a God who loves us infinitely.
Yeah. So in some ways, then, this is really a method, or a methodless method, for us to learn to pray always. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the perfection of prayer, in a sense. It's how can we take our prayer and make it something that, like Scripture tells us, to pray without ceasing.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. And what do you think then, why talk about this, you know, why talk about this today? Why is this important for those maybe who are listening, who are just beginning to learn how to pray? What's the significance here?
Yeah. Let me start with stepping back just a little bit to say, what do we mean by presence? Because I think that's an interesting concept in itself. I mean, if you look in the dictionary, you'll see presence means proximity. But we know that you can be in a room with somebody and not really be present to them. Mm-hmm. And the kind of presence that matters is that attentiveness to in a kind of I-thou relationship. Like if you're on the bus and sitting next to somebody, but you're looking at your phone and you're texting a friend who's 1,000 miles away, you're more present to that friend than you are to the person sitting next to you. Mm. And when you realize, like if you've ever been in a situation where you've seen one of these live statues, you know, and you think it's a statue and suddenly you realize it's a person, it changes the whole situation because you realize that you're in a presence with this. Mm. And I think this is what Brother Lawrence is getting at, is that we tend to forget that we're always in God's presence. And nowadays, I think we have so many things that scatter our attention. Social media and so many distractions.
And podcasts.
And so podcasts like this and so on. But to be able to kind of cultivate that realization that God is always with us. You know? And so you had asked, why is this an important topic? And I mean, I think nowadays that whole issue of how we're present to our world, to the people around us, and to reality is crucial. I'm also aware that this great scholar of mysticism, Bernard McGinn, when he talks about the history of Christian mysticism, he says, well, people nowadays think that mysticism is about having these experiences of undifferentiated unity. But he says, you look at Christian mystics, that's not their focus often. That he says, really, if you want to talk about Christian mysticism, it's what leads up to and flows from that consciousness of God's presence. And so that, I think, that sense of presence has also come to the center of discussions about spirituality today. Mm. And also I think it's very important for Carmelites because, like Edith Stein says in her essay on the history of the spirit of Carmel, that the Carmelite stands before the face of the living God, that we stand in God's presence. That's our vocation. Mm. So I think that's what Carmelites are supposed to be about, presence with God, and that's what Christian spirituality is about at its core. So that's why I think it's important.
Right. Yeah, so in some sense, it's a particular, something particular to the Carmelite vocation, but in a broader sense, it's through everyone's baptism, they're called to stand in God's presence, to be aware of God's presence. And like you said, the perfection of prayer is not these extraordinary experiences of prayer or even these great feelings in prayer. It's rather, how are we present to God who's always present to us?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, maybe we can turn now to the Carmelite friar who wrote this this book. So I have here, this book is The Practice of the Presence of God. And it's, this is a critical edition that was translated by one of our friars, Father Sal. And you'll see inside it contains, you know, many different things, and we'll get into that. But Brother Lawrence of the Resurrection was a Carmelite friar who wrote this work and kind of has this spiritual teaching. So maybe we can turn a little bit to his life and see who he is before we dive into the work itself.
Yeah. Well, from what we know, Father Conrad de Meester, who compiled this critical edition, he did a kind of exhaustive research. As anything that could be known about Brother Lawrence, he somehow uncovered it. And you'll see different dates given for his birth, but Conrad de Meester says 1614. That's what
Wikipedia says as well, so it must be true.
It must be true. And he's born in this little town called Hermanil, and I'm sorry if my French pronunciation doesn't do it justice. It's in the Lorraine part of what's now France. And the family name was Herman, and his baptismal name was Nicholas, so you sometimes see this book as written by Nicholas Herman. Mm. We don't know a lot about his family. We don't know if he had brothers and sisters. We don't know what kind of an education he got. Probably not a lot, mm-hmm. because they seem to have been a poor family. At least he knew how to read and write because he wrote letters and so on. He was, I guess, a pious young man. But at the age of 18, he says he had this kind of conversion experience where he saw a tree that, you know, had lost all its leaves because of the winter. And just reflecting on that, he thought about how God's providence was going to bring it back to life again.
Yeah.
And
Do you mind if I read that?
Yeah, just, please. I'll please.
Read. It's a pretty short passage there, but I think it's rather striking. It says, "One day in winter, while he was looking at a tree stripped of its leaves, and he realized that in a little while its leaves would reappear, followed by its flowers and fruit, he received a profound insight into God's providence that has never been erased from his soul. This insight completely freed him from the world and gave him such a love for God that he could not say it had increased during the more than 40 years that had passed."
Yeah.
Just, it's striking to me that, again, when we think of the great saints, the great mystics, we often turn to these extraordinary experiences.
Yeah.
And here is his experience. It's looking at a tree stripped of its leaves.
Yeah, and you'll often see that on editions of his of the book, that they'll just have a tree there without leaves and so on. But then what happened was he enlisted in the military. In at that time, the 30 Years' War was going on, which was, I'm not a historian, but I understand it was one of the bloodiest in modern times. And he was captured, and he was going to be executed as a spy, but he managed to convince them that he wasn't a spy and so on. He re-enlisted and got wounded and went back home to recover. And that always reminds me a bit of some of the others, like Francis of Assisi or Ignatius of Loyola, who, you know, were kind of disillusioned soldiers, and that was a turning point in their life, too. And he says, and his friend who records the conversations with him says that he had sometimes, from time to time, he would think back on the misadventures of his youth and some of the things he had done that he wasn't proud about. And and so there was, I guess during the 30 Years' War, there was a lot of looting and other kinds of, all the terrible things that go in war. So I'm sure he had a very disillusioning experience from all of that. But now, from this point on, he's starting to think like Ignatius did and other, about how is he going to serve God.
So this is after he's returned home. He's been injured in war, and he has to return home because of his injury.
Yeah. And he's thinking about, even early on, apparently, according to this friend who we'll talk about it a little bit, that he was thinking about the Carmelites a bit because he had an uncle who was with the Carmelites. But he didn't go there immediately. Like he first tried out as a kind of a hermit, and he realized he was too undisciplined, I guess, to be a good hermit, and that wasn't working for him. And then he was a valet to a nobleman, and he said he was a clumsy oaf who was always breaking things, and so he wasn't good as a valet. And so finally he does apply to the Carmelites. I think he's 26 when he applies, and he's admitted.
Where we're all clumsy.
Yeah, right.
So, and always breaking things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. I suppose this, we can figure out why he was, at that time anyway, he entered as a brother candidate, not as a priest, because he wouldn't have had the education for those who were going on for priestly studies and so on.
Yeah.
And he was older too. So he says he says God tricked him because he thought he would be skinned alive for his faults, but he found out that he was really very happy with the Carmelites, except for the inner struggle he was going through. Mm-hmm.
And so when he entered Carmel, he was 26 years old, which we say he was older, older for his time,
at
perhaps.
That time,
he's 26 years old, and in that time there wasn't as long of a period of formation. So he was 28 when he made his solemn vows, and it's really, I think, around that time that he began to experience perhaps more of this interior struggle that you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, and the spirituality of the day, they would have been training him to do these discursive meditation methods and so on, where you take a passage of scripture and you go through all of these steps and you apply yourself to it and draw conclusions and so on. And he wasn't finding that didn't work very well for him. And he also was very, he was worried about his own salvation. I mean, with his past and so on, how could he ever expect God to forgive him and all of that? And so he was struggling with that until he kind of reached a point there. I think I have a quote here where he says, "During my first 10 years, I suffered a great deal. the apprehension that I did not belong to God as I wished, my past sins always before my eyes, and the lavish graces God gave me were the sum and substance of all my woes. During this period, I fell often, but I got up just as quickly. But then he kind of comes to the, he reaches a point where he says, it seemed to me all creatures, reason, and God himself were against me, and that faith alone was on my side.
It's interesting to me. Yeah. It sounds like a lot of what he's struggling with is, this intense inner doubt and turmoil, but a lot of what we would say today is perhaps scrupulosity, fear of his own, for his own salvation, it's kind of the fear of his past sins and things like that. And one thing that struck me is, this time in France is kind of the beginning of the sort of Jansenistic movement in France. And so even though it probably hadn't quite taken hold in France yet, it was probably kind of in the waters there, this sort of this fear of God, fear of hell and all of that was probably a part of the world that he was living in.
And then he says, when I accepted the fact that I might spend my life suffering from these troubles and anxieties, which in no way diminished the trust I had in God, I found myself changed all at once, and my soul, until that time always in turmoil, experienced a deep inner peace as if it had found its center in a place of rest. And I think from there and other passages, it seems like he reached a point where he realized he can't save himself. He's just got to trust in God's mercy, which kind of reminds us of Therese saying, I go to God with empty hands. Mm-hmm. That and once he was able to reach that point, then a lot of the turmoil ceased.
And right. It wasn't even necessarily him fighting the feelings or the thoughts that came. Yeah. It was more him just accepting them.
Yeah.
And in accepting, then he found peace.
Yeah, I think so. And from that point on, he realized, well, these types of prayer weren't working for him, so he was just going to try to do everything for the love of God and try to always remain aware of God's presence and so on. And that became kind of the sum and substance of his whole spirituality. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean, that's sometimes what people don't understand, I think. It doesn't mean that he stopped going to all of the things that a religious would go to, to mass and the sacraments and all of that, but it just meant that he said, like, his retreat time, he went on retreat, but it was kind of like it all became one and the same. It was like working in the kitchen and so on, because all the time he was in God's presence.
Right. Yeah. And I think and this is a lot of the reason why his spiritual teaching can be very helpful for people today is because most of the people listening to this are not religious in a monastery, and so how can they live a life of prayer, in the midst of their busy lives? And Brother Lawrence, he spent I think the first 15 years or so of his time as a religious brother cooking in the kitchen, cooking for a large number of friars. Yeah. I think was it like 80 or 100 friars that he would cook for. So you can understand the kind of the time crunch, the stress, the busyness that would involve. And yet he was able to find a way to pray in the midst of that.
Yeah, they have these nice little posters sometimes with Brother Lawrence's picture there or whatever. But he says somewhere that, even when he's in the kitchen, he says he just flips this little omelet for the love of God and then, thanks God and so on. So whatever he's doing. And as you say, the brothers in those days, like as the brother, he had to do the cooking for the whole community. He had to receive guests at the door and so on. He had to talk to people who wanted to come and come for advice and all of that. So he had to do the shopping, all of those things. And yet in the midst of that, he's able to kind of maintain this inner peace and equanimity.
Yeah. Right. And so in some sense, then his life can be an even closer example than for, the mother who's trying to cook for her family and clean her kids and drive them to soccer practice. Yeah. And she can look to him as probably a closer example to her own life than perhaps the Carmelite priest who's living in the monastery. Yeah. So Brother Lawrence was in the kitchen for, about 15 years or so, but then he started to experience some poor health, perhaps related to his injury when he was injured in battle. And so eventually he wasn't able to keep up with the the kitchen duties, which were pretty demanding. And so he began working in the sandal shop. And you can see this, I think this is kind of another step where God was really at work here, because there was something else that he wanted Brother Lawrence to turn his attention to, perhaps. And being in the sandal shop provided him this opportunity to kind of really sit down and share his teaching with others.
Well, he says somewhere that he wasn't really naturally attracted to the kitchen work, but you know, the way he practiced the presence of God, that made it a joy for him. And as you say, he actually liked the sandal work because he could be more he could be there, not running up and down so much and so on.
And so he would ended up, you know, interacting with a lot of different people in his religious vocation, and that's perhaps the really the reason why we even know of him today is because he met with all people from all walks of life, from the poor who would come to the door, to some pretty prominent priests in Paris who would come to him for spiritual advice.
Well, he died at a relatively, I think he was about close to 80 or something when he died, and although he did have several illnesses, he at the end, you know, they said he was kind of full of joy. His only complaint was that God hadn't given him enough to suffer for love of God. You know, that he felt that God had always been so good to him and had blessed him so much, and he kind of radiated that. And they say, I mean, it stands to reason that he, you know, he was a former soldier and everything, that he had a kind of a rough exterior. And if you weren't interested in God and spiritual things, you know, he didn't want you to waste his time. But if you were serious about your faith and about loving God and so on, he had a lot of time for that. Mm. And you see that in some of his letters. I mean, he's writing to various people, lay people and sisters and so on, who are asking for his advice. And, you know, he's kind of funny in the letters. He say, well, you're going to complain because all I ever talk about is the presence of God. But he says, if I were a priest, that's all I'd ever preach about because it's so necessary.
Right. And it's interesting, when I recall Brother Lawrence, his story, it reminds me of stories I've heard of some of the brothers in our own province. Some of the brothers who are cooks, even in fact, I don't know if you have any stories or anyone in particular that you remember. I know some of the cooks would always, I hear stories of them. Even the cook who lived here, Brother Antonine, how he would, you know, someone would come to the door when he's cooking and he'd invite them in and just share God's love with them, give them something to eat, and then they'd go on their way. So.
Because I lived here with Brother Antonine for many years, and he was the one, no matter what the rest of us did for people, Antonine was the one they always remembered because he was so kind and gracious and so on, and had time for everybody.
And so, I mean, this was kind of the life of Brother Lawrence. It was a real simplicity there. He wasn't, you know, highly educated. It wasn't like he was writing volumes to be published. So, so how do we go from, you know, his simple just sharing of his wisdom to, you know, the practice of the presence of God to a book that we can, you know, hold that has 180 pages.
Well, as you were mentioning, he had eventually, as word got around, and they're in the middle of Paris, so they're kind of centrally located. In fact, part of the monastery is still there, part of the Institut Catholique in Paris, near the Luxembourg Gardens, and you can go and see that and the church. But this one person in particular was this Joseph de Beaufort, who was, I think, the vicar for the, ultimately the vicar for the Archbishop of Paris. And he had some letters of Brother Lawrence that he started showing to people, and people were very interested. They liked these. So he decided to start collecting things of Brother Lawrence, and he published, like, I think, a year or 2 years after Brother Lawrence died, he published one with some of the letters and his own little biography of him. And that was received so well that then he published a second one 2 years after that with the conversations and some additional material and so on. And that's really what, I mean, Brother Lawrence himself didn't, he wrote the letters and so on, but he didn't compile them in a book. That was what, you know, began circulating and getting a lot of attention. But then it got caught up in some other issues, and so that, I mean, that ultimately meant that it's better known outside of the Catholic world than in the Catholic world.
But, yeah, could you explain that whole situation? Yeah. Maybe just very briefly, but yeah. I find it very fascinating because, yeah. you know, I was at a conference and there was a young person who came up and, you know, they were looking at some of the books that we sell and they saw this book and they had this moment where they realized, I guess they were a fairly recent convert. Mm-hmm. They had grown up Protestant and they, even at their camp, they had stayed in a cabin at their church camp that was named after Brother Lawrence. Mm-hmm. But they always, you know, Protestants, they would often call each other brother so-and-so. And so they just thought it was this other, you know, some Protestant. They didn't realize that it was the Catholic friar, a Catholic Carmelite friar that this cabin was named after. Yeah. So it's interesting to me how his prominence has really come up in, especially in Protestant circles. Yeah.
Well, as briefly as I can, because it's very complicated. I mean, actually, nowadays, those of you who are just listening won't be able to see it, but a stack of just some of the editions in English that are available. And some of them are very concise, like sometimes they just have the letters and the conversations. Sometimes they have more material. But most of these come from Protestant publishing houses, not Catholic. But what happened was not Brother Lawrence's fault. He was in 17th century France. There was a lot of energy around spirituality and mysticism. This was the time when the Carmelites came to France and so on. But there was this movement, what later was called semi-quietism, which kind of was connected with Archbishop Fenelon and Madame Guyon. And she was a pious widow who was teaching a kind of mystical doctrine, and particularly this, that if you love God purely, then you shouldn't care about whether you're going to heaven or hell, because that's a mercenary love, you know, so you're not supposed to care about your own salvation. Well, another bishop, Bossuet, says, well, now, wait a second, that can't be right, because in the Bible, we're supposed to care about our salvation, and so on. And so this escalated back and forth, but Archbishop Fenelon, who was defending Madame Guyon, who was his directee, he started quoting from Brother Lawrence. As we said before, that Brother Lawrence had gone through that kind of crisis and then basically said, well, you know, I'm just surrendering it all to God. And actually, people like Francis de Sales had gone through something like that with how he dealt with scruples and so on, which was how you deal with a particular personal issue. It's not a kind of a theological doctrine and so on. But rightly or wrongly, the work of Bishop Fenelon, in which he had quoted Brother Lawrence, got condemned as semi-quietism, and so there was a kind of guilt by association that the Catholics thought, oh well, if he's quoting Brother Lawrence, then we better not read Brother Lawrence, but at the same time, like the Protestants, the Pietist movement among Protestants, they said, oh, well, if the Catholics are condemning it, it must be good. Yes. And so they started reading all of these things and publishing editions in German, in English, and so on. John Wesley, who was the head of the Methodists and so on, he recommended, I think he even recommended Saint Teresa and so on. He liked Catholic mystics and recommended reading them. Brother Lawrence was recommended to the Methodists and so on. I remember I visited a Bible college, like a fundamentalist Bible college once, and, you know, they knew I was a Carmelite priest and they were kind of suspicious of me. But we went into the bookstore and I said, you've got Brother Lawrence here. He was a Carmelite. I said, oh, okay, well, maybe. So
it's funny. I love that story because it sounds so much like something that would happen today where it's like, well, Brother Lawrence was caught up in this controversy he didn't even know about. It was after
he was
his
dead
death,
by that time.
And he was canceled by one side.
Yeah.
And so because he was canceled by one side, he became the hero of the other side almost. So the Protestants just really embraced him because the Catholics were saying that, that, you know, this guilt by association, which... Yeah. you know, nothing was found problematic within Brother Lawrence's works. Yeah. It was just because he was being quoted by someone else.
But. Yeah. And there are editions you'll find where they've kind of edited out anything that sounds too Catholic, where he said, like, he normally didn't need a spiritual director, but he needed a confessor to confess his sins to or something. Well, if you belong to a group that doesn't believe in confession, you know, then they sort of, oh, well, Brother Lawrence mustn't have really meant that, so they edited it out. But that's one reason why I think the ICS edition is good, because you'll get all of that, everything there. Nothing's been edited out. So
right. That's good. Yeah, so this, the ICS edition, then it's contains, you know, many of those things that we've talked about. It contains the letters that Brother Lawrence wrote, the spiritual maxims, a few of the conversations that he had, as well as, I think, a eulogy that was given about him. Yeah. Could you say something about, there's a, you know, just a couple of pages here that is actually called the practice of the presence of God. What is that work? That's probably the most well-known of the works.
Well, that, yeah, as you say, that's just a couple of pages, and it seems to be that Joseph de Beaufort took some sayings and texts and so on from the other writings and put them together. So this isn't a text that Brother Lawrence wrote himself, but it's kind of stitched together from his sayings and so
right.
on. So,
yeah, it's kind of this concise summary of his teaching. And I find, I mean, it's a good place to start, because it's just these gems. I mean, just every single sentence to me is just, they're so profound.
Yeah.
And it, like I said, it's four pages, so it makes for,
that's easy.
Pretty quick reading. Yeah. So it's a good place to start, I think, if someone is interested in reading about Brother Lawrence. But now maybe we could just even turn to then more of, like, what is the practice of the presence of God? What is it that Brother Lawrence is teaching us?
Yeah.
What is the spiritual content of his message?
Yeah.
What can he teach us about prayer?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I mean, one thing when I've talked about this is that he does give some practical advice. Maybe I'm jumping ahead to say that, about how do you practice the presence of God and so on, because it's not just a kind of a once in a while thing. He says it's something you have to get used to as a habit that you have to build up. And he says that, you know, it can't be done in isolation from a kind of an effort to live a virtuous life, that he talks about the importance of purity of life. If you're a bank robber, you know, doing the practice of the presence of God, well, it may help you toward conversion, but you're not going to be able to continue forever in this way of life and think that just by spending a few moments practicing the presence of God that makes everything okay.
Right.
So he says, you know, purity of life, or I think practice of virtue should go with, and then persistence, he says a lot of times that it's hard at first to kind of try to remember that God is present. And he says, like any activity, you start the activity remembering God's there. During the activity, you're aware of it, and after. So he says it's going to take a while before you get used to doing that, but just don't get discouraged. Just keep trying. And sometimes it can help to have a what we used to call aspirations, you know, some little prayer that you use, God, I'm yours, or something like that, he says, helped him to try when he found his attention wandering.
Right.
And
Could you say something? I mean, does Brother Lawrence maybe give us any teaching on this? It seems like if I'm always so focused on God that I wouldn't be able to, like, be present to another person or to be present to my job or my kids. So what does he mean by, like, is it that I always have to be, like, talking with God in my mind at the same time as I'm trying to do something else? Like, practically, what would you say that looks like?
I mean, that's a little hard to say, I think. And he talks about it as kind of carrying on this conversation all the time with what, you know, it's kind of an interior conversation. Okay, Lord, it's time to cook now. Or, let's, you know, I got to spend the next hour studying for my exam tomorrow. Or the baby needs feeding, Lord, let's go together and feed the baby or whatever. That sort of thing. But you're still attentive to the task at hand, I think.
Yeah. Right. It's almost inviting God into that task with you.
Yeah,
and like you said, being aware of him before, during and after that time of whatever it is, whatever your responsibility is.
Yeah, yeah. like, I mean, that whole image about flipping this omelet for the love of God and then thanking God that you were able to do it and so on.
Yeah. Thank you, God. Right. Yeah. That it can be hard flipping your omelet without everything falling out.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Something to be grateful for.
Yeah. And it does seem, I mean, de Beaufort didn't find Brother Lawrence preoccupied or anything like that. I mean, he right. was a very easy person for him to talk to and was very attentive to the person he was talking to.
Yeah, I think that's an important point because I think if we were to misunderstand this, you would think that the goal is to be kind of aloof.
Yeah.
And just like, well, I'm always up in heaven talking to God, so I'm excused from being present to the person who needs me in front of me. And yet, if we're truly living this, we're going to be more attentive to our occupations, to those in our life. And that's really, we know that because Brother Lawrence lived it.
Yeah. And I mean, God is present in everything during everything we're doing and so on. So it's not like you have to have a split attention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if you have any particular quotes that you'd like to point out from, you know, either his writing, his conversations or anything like that. Anything else you'd like to expand on? Like I said, I think there's just so much, especially from this short work, The Practice of the Presence of God. It's like every single sentence, there's so much that you can pull out there and reflect on throughout the day.
One thing is kind of interesting, too, is he does all of the normal things that you're supposed to do as a practicing Catholic and so on. But he says... he stresses often the importance of faith almost as much as John of the Cross does, which he says, instead of taking faith as our rule and guide, we amuse ourselves with insignificant, constantly changing devotions. He says, this way of faith is the mind of the church and is all we need to reach perfection. So he, again, I don't think he's against devotions, but he just means you don't need to complicate your life with God. It can be just this simple a practice of trying to live in God's presence all the time.
Right.
So
yeah, another quotation like that that I could see again a Protestant maybe trying to latch onto and use against the Catholic teaching is he says we do not always have to be in church to be with God. Mm-hmm. We can make of our hearts an oratory where we can withdraw from time to time to converse with Him there. Which, of course, is so true, I mean, from the scriptures itself. So it's not saying that we shouldn't go to the church and pray in front of the Blessed Sacrament, but it's saying we can pray always because God is always present within us through our baptism. We can always meet Him there. So we can pray in the time of adoration, the time of church, but also going about our daily responsibilities.
Yes, I have so many quotes underlined here that I wouldn't get through them all if I started going... well, he even like this one where he's writing to a soldier, which I always found a bit odd. He says, even, you know, you can practice the presence of God even when you're with sword in hand, you know, which I guess a soldier to soldier, he can say that. But I think it means like there's no occupation in which this isn't applicable.
Yeah.
So that always struck me.
Maybe I could ask you a question about, you know, you read at the beginning kind of a definition of the practice of the presence of God. And one thing that's really striking to me from that is he says, he's talking about when we should, turn our presence to God. And he says, especially in times of temptation, suffering, aridity, weariness, even infidelity and sin.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is kind of just mind-blowing, this idea that we can turn to God even in those moments.
Yeah. Well, to me, I think he reminds me a lot of Saint Teresa because she talks about how, you know, we can have this false humility that because we're sinful or because we're actually fallen into a serious sin or something like that, that we should avoid prayer. And she says, you know, prayer is always the solution, not the problem. And so even if we know we've strayed far or something, it's only going to make things worse not to. Practicing the presence of God will help us in that turning back to God and so on.
Yeah.
And so he never got discouraged, even when he realized he'd fallen. You know, he said he just got up and continued on with the with this practice.
Right. Yeah, because when we despair over our sins, I've heard it said the devil wins twice.
Yeah, exactly.
He wins in our original sin, but he wins perhaps even more so in our despair.
Yeah.
And so when we can turn to his presence, even in infidelity and sin, not that we're celebrating the sin, but we're celebrating his mercy. Yeah. He's meeting us.
Yeah. And I think in a way, I mean, practicing the presence of God, realizing that he loves us, but it also helps us to realize that we need this conversion, that we're, you know, that it's an incentive to like the prodigal son, you know, that, thinking about the father and so on.
Right,
right. Yeah.
Well, maybe we can close in with just to get really practical. I mean, we've talked some practical here, but you know, if a person wants to practice the presence of God, it sounds like it's something that's so simple that it's hard to like even explain. How would you do it? But I don't know if you have any suggestions or advice that you would give if someone wanted to try to practice this in their own life.
Yeah, well, I would think maybe negatively we could look at some, you know, what are the things that are distracting us? Because we're not going to be able to practice this if our mind is scattered all over the place, and see what we can do to eliminate some of the distractions. And, you know, turn off the phone once in a while, or go to some quiet place or whatever, especially at the beginning when we're trying to build up the habit. I think once you've got the habit well in place, then the interruptions won't be as disturbing. But I think at the beginning anyway, taking some time to just to kind of rest in the presence of God, and then trying to, as he says, just try to do it during the day. If you find something that is helpful, like I mean, Teresa would say a little picture you can look at, or a little prayer you can say, or whatever to kind of help remind you. But again, keep it simple.
One thing that I try to do sometimes, I haven't kept this up consistently, and since I've been in Carmel, but at times I've tried to be more focused on this. That I would do is, you know, I'd go to Mass in the morning in the monastery, and then when I leave Mass, I'd say, "Okay, Jesus, come with me to my next task." And then I'd go to my next task. Maybe that was, you know, doing some studies or some reading. And then when I left that room to go somewhere else, I'd say, "Jesus, come with me to this next place." And if ever I found that I'd forgotten Jesus somewhere, then I could go back to the chapel and say a prayer and invite him to come with me again. Yeah. So, I mean, not everyone lives in a monastery where there's a chapel. Yeah. So it may not be practical in that sense, but just this kind of awareness of trying to bring Jesus with you with each task, with each time you change locations, to say that quick prayer to bring him with you throughout the day. There's those little kind of almost childish, but little just practical tricks that we can do to kind of build this habit in our lives.
Well, and I think, I mean, that's one of the advantages in religious life, is you have these moments of prayer punctuating the day, when it kind of says, okay, why are we here? What are we doing? And all this, so it kind of brings you back to the presence of God. When you've got a very hectic schedule, that's not easy. But people can, you know, have like, okay, I'm going to remember the Angelus at lunchtime every day or something like that. Simple things, I think.
Right, or even connecting things like, every time I get frustrated in traffic, I'm going to remember to turn to God's presence. Or every time I get irritated with my coworker or my spouse, like this can be an invitation to turn to God's presence.
Yeah. So whatever little reminders help us during the day, you know, set your watch to give you a signal every 2 hours
or something. A little shock every 5 minutes.
Whatever,
That's great. Well, thank you, Father Stephen. Do you have anything else that you want to comment on?
No, I just want to say thank you for inviting me to talk about this. I worked with Father Salvatore, the translator, on this book, and it was really a pleasure working on it, and I learned so much myself. So I hope others too will, who, if they don't know Brother Lawrence, that they'll take time to read him, because it's so simple. And
another book that we publish at ICS is this short little book, and it's a retreat with Brother Lawrence of the Resurrection. It just has 7 days with some reflections. Short reflections based on the teaching, the wisdom of Brother Lawrence of the Resurrection. A really short book, so it'd be a great gift for someone too who is maybe just getting back into their life of prayer, spiritual life, kind of a jump start into a life of prayer. So it's pretty simple, and I think something that, you know, anyone would appreciate. So I highly recommend that. Well, thank you again, Father Stephen, and God bless you. Hope to see you back for our next episode.